Welcome to Acute Leukemias Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Wendy Stock from the University of Chicago, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
This was a 70-year-old man who was treated in central Illinois initially for a diagnosis of precursor B-ALL. He was treated there a couple of years ago with the hyper-CVAD regimen for ALL, which is commonly used in the community and at many academic centers. He had some trouble with the regimen in the sense that he had multiple episodes of neutropenia and neutropenic sepsis during the regimen, and he did complete 6 out of the 8 courses of the hyper-CVAD, but then the physicians chose to discontinue because of the increasing frequency of neutropenia. So similarly, he was not, for reasons that I still don't understand, given any maintenance therapy. So about 8 months after his initial completion of the hyper-CVAD regimen without any maintenance therapy, he presented with a relapse of disease.
So before you continue on, maybe we can just stop for a second and think a little bit about the case up to this point. And I guess one question, and I don't know whether maybe you can address it as it relates to this specific man, but in general, I mean, it struck me that this patient was managed in the community. The patient was managed by a general medical oncologist who takes care of a lot of things?
Yes, in a large practice in one of the larger cities in central Illinois.
And to what extent was this because the patient preferred it? They didn't want to go to a tertiary center?
I think that's a lot of it with patients. I mean, this gentleman is a farmer, has a very large farm, very busy guy. And I don't think that he thought about even getting referred to an academic center. It would be a couple hours away. And I think he preferred to get treated there, though I don't know the reasons. And many times we see patients who are treated initially in the community for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is not an easy disease to treat, and a disease with which there's not a huge amount of familiarity in the community because of its rarity and the complexity of the treatment.
It sounds like, in retrospect, you're not that confident that the plan was appropriate.
That's true. I think this is a very reasonable regimen. It's not one that I use a lot, especially in the older adults with ALL. And I think it's an increasingly difficult regimen to give with age, as patients age. And so I'm not sure that that would have been chosen, but nevertheless, it was chosen and it is a very standard regimen. This group often communicates with us, actually, but I had not specifically heard about this patient until the relapse.
Just out of curiosity, you know, it's always easy to use the retrospectoscope, and this patient, of course, had problems with hyper-CVAD, but what do you think typically you might have utilized?
You know, it's a challenging area, the older adult with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and actually there's some very interesting new therapies that are being tailored specifically to the older adult with precursor B-ALL with some of the novel agents that are coming forward. And there's a regimen currently being tested by the U.S. intergroup, cooperative groups, that really uses minimal chemotherapy, but uses targeted antibody therapies for older adults with ALL, precursor B.
What's the specific regimen?
This is one, it's a SWOG-led study, but it's a U.S. intergroup study because we cooperate, all three large cooperative groups cooperate. And it's a study, and this is just, it's a very early phase study, but it's a study of just dexamethasone intrathecal therapy and blinatumomab frontline therapy for older adults with precursor B-ALL that are not pH positive.
So blinatumomab in older adults, how about toxicity issues?
You know, it seems to be actually pretty well tolerated in the patients whom I've treated now in older adults. This is in the frontline setting. And interestingly, I was worried that one might see a lot of CNS toxicity because they have bulk disease. It's new diagnosis. But interestingly, I've treated now a couple of patients on this regimen and they've tolerated it very well.
Do you think that they tolerate it better? Do you think that the older immune system doesn't respond as much?
Well, that's a really good question. And I've wondered about the same thing. I don't know. And it's really literally a handful of patients that I've treated on this regimen. But I've wondered about that, whether perhaps there is some decrease in sensitivity to these agents in terms of the neurotoxicity and the cytokine release system, possibly because of a slightly impaired immune system. On the other hand, these are patients without prior therapy for their ALL, so they aren't particularly overall immunocompromised, unlike in the relapse setting where they're often already fairly heavily pretreated.
I know it's kind of a mind shift. You know, there are not that many patients out there, and so it's great to be able to talk to somebody like yourself who had the experience, but trying to think about blinatumomab up front, I mean, what kind of anti-tumor activity are you seeing in this trial?
Well, you know, it's early, and I'm not the principal investigator of the trial, but I was myself quite skeptical because its activity with bulk disease has not been as good as when you have less marrow involvement. Interestingly, I've treated 3 patients on this regimen, and 2 have gone into remission. 1 has not, although even that patient had some improvement in her blood counts.
So just again, maybe sticking a little bit with the issue of upfront therapy of ALL, what about the issue of selection of chemotherapy, and particularly the idea that, of course, you've done so much work on pediatric-inspired type regimens. How do you sort of think that through, and how old will you consider a patient? 70 seems like a little bit old to even think about it, but you tell me.
Well, you're asking me really great questions that I struggle with every day. One of the things that I wonder about, and I agree that 70 is getting up there in terms of considering one of these regimens frontline. On the other hand, I think the major toxicity of these regimens has to do largely, not exclusively by any means, with modulating both the steroids and the asparaginase. And I think that there's a lot of room for improvement there. And one of the things that is slowly being introduced, at least in pilot studies, is targeting the dose of asparaginase using lower doses and measuring asparaginase levels, and also using pulse steroids rather than continuous steroids. And that's been done quite a lot in the older population. It seems to be better tolerated in terms of less toxicity, sepsis, and prolonged bad hyperglycemia, pancreatitis. So I think it seems to be better tolerated. The issue of the asparaginase is a really tricky one and one that really needs more investigation. So I'd be too cavalier to say, yes, it can be done, but I believe that there's room for improvement. And we've done some much lower dosing of asparaginase in older adults, not up to the age of 70, with targeting the level and adjusting the dose accordingly. And it seems to be better tolerated, but I don't have enough data. And these are small prospective studies that are being done at a couple of places.
So it seems like, you know, maybe if this patient had come to you or came to you today, that trial certainly would be a great option. But let's just say the trial wasn't an option. Best estimate, what do you think the patient would have been treated with in your hands?
Well, there's also another trial that is open in the U.S. intergroup, starting at the age of 40, with a more standard regimen, not a hyper-CVAD regimen, but an asparaginase-containing regimen with dose modifications for older adults. It's the U.S. intergroup study, and that's probably the study I would have enrolled this patient on. That study is testing blinatumomab, actually also frontline, but not as a single agent in the setting of minimal residual disease.
So that also sounds like a great option, but let's say that that's not the option. Outside of trial, what do you think you would have done?
Right. Well, I think what I would have done outside of a trial is I would have done a dose modification of a standard ALL regimen. And I think that that can result in high response rates, high remission rates. The issue, of course, with older adults is the problem with relapse, just like it is in the younger adults, with higher toxicity rates. So the survival in older adults with precursor BALL has been very poor, overall less than 20% long-term survival. And so I really do think that despite the fact that we treat these patients in the community because of these poor responses as much as possible, it should be appropriate, it would be appropriate to enroll them on national trials that are available at community centers, actually, if you have the research mechanism to do so. And many of these larger community oncology groups actually are set up to do clinical trial work.
I mean, in a way, for a disease like ALL, you got to be if you want to give standard of care. I mean, these two trials to me sound like better than anything you could do in, you know, outside a trial.
I agree. And I think that as we're moving forward, there's some very fascinating ideas percolating about combining some of these novel antibodies together or in sequence to treat older adults, which really might make a huge difference.
So any case write-up that includes the words "very frightening" always gets my attention. Let's hear what happened with this man.
Okay, so he came to see us a year ago now, and he was quite ill, actually. He had received a salvage regimen at the local place, and then he even received, first he received chemotherapy, then he received blinatumomab, and he had no response. And in the meantime, he also developed a horrible fungal infection. It was actually a fungal sinusitis. I have a pneumonia there. It was actually a fungal sinusitis, and he had to have some debridement done, and he had an active fungal infection when he came to see us. So we initially evaluated that to make sure it wasn't actively spreading while we were sort of temporizing him with pulse, I think steroids and vincristine for a couple of weeks. Then we entered him on a CAR T-cell trial, which, as you may know, the initial thing is you need to be off of steroids for a bit of time because you don't want to be so immunocompromised that you can't collect the T-cells.
Which CAR T product did he receive?
He received the Juno trial, Juno CAR T, which is no longer being tested in older adults.
But this, just for the audience, is a CD19 preparation.
Yes, it's a CD19 CAR. So what happens is you apherese the patients, collect their cells, they're sent off, and within about 10 days, it's actually quite quick, 10 days to 14 days, the product returns. In that interim, you can give some rescue chemotherapy. And I can't actually, at this moment, remember what we gave this gentleman. Not too much, because we didn't want to make him the risk of more mucosal damage to exacerbate his fungal infection. He then received the CAR T-cell product. Patients are admitted to the hospital. And sure enough, within about 24 hours after receiving the cells, he started having high fevers.
That's a little bit, you said sure enough, but I mean, that sounds a little early. I've been hearing like 5 to 7 days more.
Well, it can happen very quickly, actually. 24 to 48 hours is not so uncommon, but you're right. In people with less bulk disease, sometimes it takes about 5 to 7 days before those symptoms appear. And I've seen it that way as well. This guy had a marrow packed with leukemia. And I think maybe these T cells actually were quite active. So he started having fevers. He was okay. But about, I would say about 24 hours later, we noticed that he was starting to have some word finding difficulties. He seemed a little less responsive, a little less sharp.
And you thought it was kind of beyond the fact that he had a fever. Was he hypotensive?
He was not hypotensive. And there are specific modifications or additions that one implements at the time of high fever if it's persisting. And he did receive a dose of tocilizumab, which is the anti-IL-6 antibody, which is important for mediation and modulation of the cytokine release syndrome. And his fevers were actually improving a bit, although he was still quite febrile, not hypotensive. But then his mental status really started to deteriorate. He became almost catatonic very quickly. We had already implemented, actually, high-dose steroids.
Could I just clarify, too, because I've heard this story before. When you say catatonic, in other words, he wasn't somnolent. Or was he somnolent, encephalopathic, or more sort of aphasic type?
It was sort of a combination. Initially, he was more aphasic. He was sort of awake. He would look around, but he was not speaking. And then later, it was much more an encephalopathy.
Because I've heard, you know, about this aphasia. I don't know. Is it really specific to CAR T?
I don't know. I've never actually seen anything like this before. Although blinatumomab, you can see something similar. I've seen it a couple of times. So it is probably a cytokine-mediated effect. But this is so dramatic. And it's very frightening because, you know, of course, we've read about the cerebral edema, the rapid cerebral edema that can occur.
I was going to ask you, did you image him and did he have any cerebral edema?
He did not. He did not have cerebral edema. And we repeated his spinal tap and there were no cells. But interestingly, the inflammatory component in the CSF was incredibly prominent.
Really?
Yes.
So what, T cells?
There were lymphocytes in the CSF, and his CRP at the time was probably over close to 100, I believe.
Wow.
And so he was clearly having an incredibly active cytokine-mediated storm. And, you know, although the CNS issue has not yet been completely defined in terms of what's going on up there, I can only imagine that it is completely inflamed in the meninges.
Were you saying to yourself, because I don't know exactly how much correlation there is between cytokine release or the CNS problems and benefit, when you saw this, were you saying, like, that's a good thing, hopefully?
Yeah, well, they say that there has to be, in the literature that I've read and talking to some of the people who've really done a lot of this work, that you almost have to have a little bit of that in order to be, it's sort of a biomarker for response.
Right. That's why I asked, because I sort of have heard it. So that's the part where it got very frightening, I guess.
Very, very frightening. And he became completely encephalopathic. And then he ended up getting intubated.
Wow.
In part for airway protection.
Wow.
Yes, this was about 4 to 5 days after the initial infusion. And shortly thereafter, in part from trauma, from really nothing that we should probably advertise, he had trauma from an NG tube that was placed.
Wow.
Which shouldn't have probably been done at all for airway protection because he had a bad nosebleed. He was intubated because he was not able to clear his secretions.
Wow.
He then, about 72 hours after that, got extubated, but was completely somnolent, not awake. And I didn't know what the course would be. I had spoken to other people around the country, including the folks at Memorial Sloan Kettering who helped develop this Juno CAR T. And they said, oh, just continue the steroids. It can last a couple of days, maybe a week. And this just kept going on and on. He was not able to eat. We eventually did put in a PEG, actually, and we were able to support this guy. His fever subsided very rapidly, actually.
What was going on with the disease while this was going on?
So this is really interesting. He became very cytopenic. He was already very cytopenic, became more cytopenic, but a marrow assessment showed no evidence of disease shortly, like I think day 8 or day 14. Yeah, no evidence of disease, no recovery yet. But gradually, over the course of about 3 weeks, his counts did recover. His counts actually recovered before he woke up. And we were very worried. I did not know if he was going to ever wake up. And it literally lasted about 4.5 weeks.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like it. We eventually tapered off the steroids because I knew we couldn't keep that kind of dosing of Dex going on.
Did you give him any more tocilizumab?
We gave quite a number of doses of tocilizumab, but it doesn't get into the CNS. So it's not an effective therapy there. And so we really were just giving it time and hoping that he might wake up because there was really nothing on imaging that suggested that he might not. And eventually, one day, he actually did kind of just wake up. It's almost like Sleeping Beauty. And he was not normal by any means, but he was pretty aware of his surroundings. And he was so, of course, debilitated, having been bedbound for 5 weeks nearly, even though during that time we had the therapist working sort of with him to at least maintain some mobility. He eventually went to rehab for several weeks, very, very debilitated. And he recovered completely. He's been in a complete remission with no evidence of minimal residual disease and was able just last month to go to Hawaii on a family vacation.
Wow.
He's farming again. But the worry, of course, is he's now almost a year out. This was in late October that he received the CAR T cells. And so the question will be, will he relapse? And we don't know that. You know, the durability of these CAR T cells and the durability of responses is still something that's not very well described. And in fact, in some of the literature, it suggests that sometimes people do very, very well. Other patients, and I've had one of these patients, after about a year and 3 months, she had an extramedullary relapse of her disease. So it's not very clear, and I think it's based partially on the CAR T cell construct, the vector that is introduced to the T cells. And I think we still have a lot to learn about durability.
What do we know about treatment of people who relapse after CAR T? What did you do with this lady? Can you repeat the CAR T?
You can, and it's been done. And she actually did have a second infusion. She was not treated at our center. Her initial treatment was at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and she did not respond to the second infusion. She got a lower dose, and eventually we were able to rescue her with inotuzumab, the anti-CD22 conjugate that was actually just approved.
I was going to ask you about that. So what happened with this patient? The patient got inotuzumab alone?
No, she got inotuzumab. We got her back into a second remission, or actually a third remission, and she just has had about 160 days ago now a second allogeneic transplant using a different donor. She had had an initial transplant with a very early relapse, which is when we first met her a couple of years ago. So this was a second allo transplant. She's doing actually great, but I was worried about not doing something. Obviously, the durability of responses after any of this stuff is still unknown. And with inotuzumab, we know that the durability of response is not long.
I was going to ask you about inotuzumab. Can you talk a little bit about exactly what it is, how it works, what we know about it, and how you're going to use it?
Inotuzumab is an anti-CD22 conjugate. It is conjugated to calicheamicin, which is a drug that many people in the leukemia community are familiar with because it's the conjugate for gemtuzumab, ozogamicin. And it is a drug that has an extraordinarily high response rate in relapsed disease and just got approved. So the question is now about inotuzumab is how we're going to use it. It has as high almost a response rate as the CAR T cells, actually. It's got an 83% response rate, complete response with incomplete count recovery.
What about tolerability?
It's actually extraordinarily well tolerated. It's given as an outpatient weekly times three.
But no peripheral neuropathy like we see, say, with bevacizumab?
Not at all. The big worry about inotuzumab, as was with gemtuzumab, is the hepatic toxicity.
Right.
And so I think that that is very much dependent on the prior therapies. But otherwise, it's actually quite a well-tolerated drug. There's sometimes an infusion-related fever with the first dose. But other than that, it's actually extraordinarily well-tolerated. There is no neuropathy.
So it seems like, and I've been hearing that there's likely going to be an approval for CAR T in ALL, right?
Yes.
Soon. Is that going to be in adults too?
I think the initial approval will be in children. And that was what was recommended by the FDA about a month ago. But I think the approval, that's children, including young adults, I think up to the age of 24 or something. And then later this fall, I think we anticipate that there might be an approval in adults.
I guess my question is, if you do see an approval in ALL in adults, so now you've got CAR T, you've got inotuzumab, you've got blinatumomab, just for starters, or maybe other things you ought to tell me about, at least those three, like, how are you going to sequence them?
That's a really good question. And I think that one of the things that's being done already is that the antibodies, blina and inotuzumab, are being incorporated into frontline therapy. We just opened a new trial in the young adult population, which is going to test the ability of inotuzumab to improve outcomes in young adults with ALL, sort of sandwiched into a pediatric regimen.
So I want to move on and talk about AML, where it seems like there's even more happening. But I have to just take a breath because I've got to ask you, you know, this patient, the farmer that had this amazing clinical course, I'm just kind of curious how that affected you as a person.
You know, I could not tell you how thrilled I was to see that man wake up. He has a most amazing wife. She is strong, and she was there by his side most of the time. And I really think that her patience was so much of a boost to us because we all felt horrible about this. And I really didn't know. Nobody could tell me what the course of this guy would be. And as I called around, nobody had had somebody for that long of a time in such a sort of catatonic, comatose state. And so for me, every time I see this guy, it's like the best, one of those thrills that we as oncologists, hematologists live for. So right now he's truly enjoying his life. He's completely sharp, completely back together, most worried about his harvest this fall, and tells me that it's not going to be quite as good as last year's, but still going to be okay. So it's pretty amazing.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
So let's hear about your 78-year-old lady.
Okay. So she's a patient who came to us. She had had a brief history or a brief diagnosis of polycythemia vera that really had never been treated. She was on hydroxyurea for a brief period of time, and she did have a JAK mutation, JAK2 mutation, and she presented to us with pancytopenia, a very fibrotic marrow with really atypical megakaryocytes, consistent with an antecedent myeloproliferative disorder. And so whether she truly had PV or myelofibrosis, I'm not sure, but she had an antecedent myeloproliferative disorder that very rapidly evolved into acute myeloid leukemia. And I find these amongst the most challenging cases because they tend to have very much chemotherapy resistance. So she was quite a fit woman, 78 years old, but very fit, and wanted to go forward with some form of therapy. I was worried because of the antecedent history, and our practice now is to do, because we have a number of trials ongoing that allow patients to be receiving in the frontline some of these novel targeted agents, we do a rapid genomic screening. And within 5 days, usually, we can screen for the most common abnormalities that we can target, which include FLT3 and IDH1 and 2 mutations.
Are those the three things that you're most concerned about because of the fact that there are targeted therapies?
Well, those are among the things that I'm most concerned about because of the targeted therapy. We're also very interested in seeing what other potential mutations are present, including the P53 mutation, which, of course, is particularly challenging disease. But yes, right now we're most concerned with those, the presence of a FLT3, IDH1 or IDH2. And of course, the other common leukemias that we see, which don't require genomic sequencing, but just require a good cytogeneticist and good hematopathology, including the core binding factor leukemias, because we steer them in one direction as well. And we also, of course, want to know that it's not acute promyelocytic leukemia. But for the genomic mutations, right now, we're most interested in the IDH1, IDH2, and FLT3 mutations. And so because many of these trials require samples and prior consents, it's a bit daunting for patients because we have to consent them to a number of things up front. And actually, that's one of the things that's being explored now nationally in a trial called the BEAT AML trial, which is sponsored by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which is allowing broad screening up front and within 7 days assignment to a particular trial, an umbrella trial, so to speak.
Wow, that's awesome. That kind of reminds me of like the MATCH trial.
It's only if you have a particular mutation will you be able to get treated. With this umbrella trial, even if there's no targetable mutation, you're still enrolled on a different arm of the trial.
But again, this is AML.
This is AML.
Wow.
Older adult.
You know, if I told you that 10 years ago, that's what would be going on with AML now, would you believe it?
I was hoping it about 10 years ago, and I still don't know that it's going to make a huge difference, but I hope it will.
But I mean, just to have that infrastructure to be able to study the disease is incredible. Wow.
Exactly.
I like the name too, BEAT AML.
I give that LLS a lot of credit for chaperoning this forward, because we tried to do it through the NCI and they were not able to come up with the funding to allow us to do this kind of a basket umbrella trial, screening trial.
So who's funding it?
The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of America. Yeah.
Wow.
Along with pharma partners. Yeah.
Wow. So cool.
Yeah,
so,
it is. But she was enrolled, actually, she was consented for a frontline trial in combination. And it came back 5 days later that she did have an IDH2 mutation. And she was enrolled in a trial for older adults that you can have a fit arm and an unfit arm. And although she was fit, so to speak. She was 78 years old, and we enrolled her on the arm of the trial that had hypomethylating agent, azacitidine, plus the IDH2 inhibitor and asitinib. And
did they ever think about just doing anacetinib alone?
Yes, actually, one of the arms of this Beat AML trial is anacetinib alone.
Because, I mean, I have heard stories, and I'm curious about the data on this drug as well as the IDH1 drug, but I've heard stories of monotherapy where people had great remissions.
Yes, and in fact, one of the cases that I have there is a gentleman, actually he's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Chicago, who has been treated as single agent with the anacetinib for a refractory disease and has done extraordinarily well for now more than a year, which is very gratifying. So she was enrolled on that trial, and this was not a very rapid response. She had a lot of trouble initially with complications. She had a small CNS bleed. She had a period of bacteremia, and I really was worried that she might not leave the hospital. But amazingly, again, after literally 60 days in the hospital, she recovered enough to go home, and she actually has no evidence of overt disease, no increase in blasts. Now, we've had to do a lot of dose modifications of the azacitidine and of the anacetinib, some dose reductions and some delays in therapy. But so far, she's now tolerating it extraordinarily well. She was very platelet refractory for a while. Now she has an interestingly good platelet count, over 100,000 now. And although her blood counts are not 100% normal, as I said, her marrow shows no evidence of increase in blasts. And she's continuing on the trial.
So I'm curious, how do you separate the toxicities out of azacitidine versus anacetinib? And what do you think, like other than cytopenias, do you see any other sort of tolerability issues with anacetinib?
Yeah, well, that's a drug I don't have the world's greatest experience with yet in terms of numbers of patients. We were not one of the centers that did the early trials. So I don't know, but to me, one of the biggest complications of that drug actually does seem to be a little GI toxicity and some cytopenias. I do think it enhances the cytopenias that are induced by the hypomethylating agents.
Just out of curiosity, if this particular woman, 78 years old, had not had the IDH2 mutation, and particularly outside a trial, what would you have done?
What we would have done in this patient, and we do have some data from a trial that my colleague Toyosi Odeniki performed a number of years ago of 10 days of decitabine therapy for patients with a history of prior myeloproliferative disease that evolved into acute myeloid leukemia. And that has also been tested nationally and internationally for patients, older adults with AML. But we have specific experience in the patients with antecedent myeloproliferative disease and with reasonable response rates of about 40%. So we've been encouraged by that. And that's probably what we would have offered her. And that would have also been able to be given in the community.
Just a sort of a side issue, and I don't know if it really would be relevant to this patient, but just in terms of AML in general, any comments on the newly approved CPX agent or preparation?
Actually, you know, your point is a really good one because in a way, she might have been eligible for that.
That's what I was
that
thinking with the hydroxyurea. I mean, you know, I guess you believe it's just the evolution, but I'm curious what you think about the CPX.
I think it's really interesting.
Could you explain what it is and what we know about it?
Sure. It's a drug. It's actually just a reformulation of cytarabine and daunorubicin. It was developed quite a long time ago now in the early 2000s.
But it's liposomal.
It's liposomal, and it's in a specific molar ratio, 5-to-1 molar ratio of cytarabine to daunorubicin, which through a lot of preclinical testing was the optimal delivery concentration. And the interesting part about this drug is that it has slow release, so more prolonged exposure, and also very local microenvironmental potentially effects because of the geography of where the drug disseminates. So it's quite interesting.
Is the main issue that it seems like to be more effective or less toxic or both?
Many of the same toxicities occur. Interestingly, one of the toxicities that doesn't occur is hair loss, which is not one of the most important, but patients do not lose their hair with this drug, which is kind of interesting.
That is interesting.
But the cytopenias still occur, but I think it's more the efficacy.
Right.
And it just got approved. And particularly for this high-risk, older adult, therapy-related population, therapy-related leukemia population.
Well, yeah, I thought that was really wild and interesting that that's the approval. And I mean, do you think there's some reason to think it wouldn't work in non-secondary AML?
That's a really good question. It's a question that all of us are asking, including the pediatric community. And so I would say no, there's no reason to think it wouldn't, but it hasn't yet been really tested in that setting.
Because I've been hearing about all this and I've been thinking to myself, I guess if you believe in it, and then you got to get it paid for, like maybe you ought to look for a reason. Like I just heard about a case of a patient who got breast radiation after a lumpectomy 10 years previously. And that was used as the rationale to give this agent. Although, I don't know, would you see AML from breast radiation?
That's a controversial question, whether radiation alone induces therapy-related.
Right, no chemo. The lady never got chemo.
You know, there isn't a lot of evidence supporting that, actually, just radiation alone.
But I mean, like, to me, it was a way to get the drug in a way.
Right. I think you can call it therapy-related leukemia, and by definition, it's therapy-related leukemia. But in fact, the evidence for radiation alone is not very strong.
Even deeper radiation than breast radiation, you know, say mediastinal?
Yeah. Well, certainly nuclear radiation exposure for sure.
Right.
Yes.
Sure. So anyhow, getting back to IDH mutations in general, can you talk about what agents are available for IDH 1 and 2 and the approval situation and how you're utilizing them in your practice?
Right. So I haven't yet started this. All of this, it's an amazing summer for leukemia in terms of drug approval. We've waited 17 years in AML for a drug, and all of a sudden, three drugs get approved in the summer. And gemtuzumab has been reapproved, so four drugs. So the enasidenib, there's an IDH1 and an IDH2 inhibitor. The IDH1 is a little earlier in its development, but it's very similar in terms of its mechanism of action and in terms of its side effects. I forgot to mention an important side effect of enasidenib, the IDH2 inhibitor, which is actually something that we see in acute promyelocytic leukemia, which is a differentiation syndrome.
Right, right.
And that can be quite profound and quite difficult to manage. And the drug has to be held and steroids need to be given. And it's managed much the same, as far as I know, and I don't personally have a lot of experience with it yet, as the retinoids and arsenic in acute promyelocytic leukemia.
So enasidenib, as you said, has been approved. I see ivosidenib as an IDH1 inhibitor. I don't know if there are other ones. Are these TKIs?
No, they are not. It's so fascinating. These are actually agents that go back to basic biochemistry and metabolism. And
right, the Krebs cycle.
Exactly, the Krebs cycle. So right. Isocitrate dehydrogenase. So with these mutations, the normal Krebs cycle, the normal metabolism is deregulated, and there's an accumulation of alpha-ketoglutarate in these patients with IDH1 and IDH2 mutations, and that causes epigenetic deregulation and impairment differentiation block. So these drugs are actually quite specific. They actually inhibit the enzyme. And by inhibiting the mutant enzyme, you get restoration of hopefully normal epigenetic regulation and differentiation. And that's why you see this differentiation syndrome.
So this lady that you treated with the IDH2 inhibitor and azacitidine, was that on your mind? Were
yes.
you looking for it?
And yes, we were. And we were wondering about it at one point. But often with these patients, I think similar to what we see in acute promyelocytic leukemia, and from what I've read, is that there's a very, very rapid leukocytosis that occurs with fever, and you can get pulmonary infiltrates, all of the same things. It's a differentiation syndrome. And We were looking for it. We were considering it. She never had the leukocytosis, but she did have fevers. She did have some mental status changes, but we had explanations for many of these things other than she had a CNS bleed, and she was very, very debilitated. And the reason she had the CNS bleed is that she had refractory thrombocytopenia. We could not find good platelet product for her, even with HLA-matched platelets. But the other interesting thing, and this is, we were given approval for this adjunct. We added a megakaryocyte stimulating factor for this particular patient, and we were allowed to give that drug, which is approved for ITP, to this particular patient.
And was it helpful?
Yes, I think it was. And we haven't stopped it yet. You know, I don't know what helped. The point that we were so worried about was that we were worried she would bleed to death and have another CNS bleed. And the issue was that her platelet count was often in the 1 to 2,000 range, impossibly low, even with HLA-matched platelets. And so we were hoping that even with her dysfunctional, she still had a lot of megakaryocytes in her marrow, even with those dysfunctional megakaryocytes, we might get some promotion of maturation.
So I'm getting the feeling that making rounds with you must be very thrilling.
Very thrilling. Very thrilling. Very exhausting.
Wow. I'm exhausted just listening to it.
I know. I'm exhausted thinking about it because I start on service on Monday, actually.
So. All right. Well, now that you have this agent approved, how are you going to use it?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's approved right now for relapsed IDH2 mutation as a single agent. And I think there's worry about combinations. That needs to be tested in trials. People shouldn't, I don't think, be using these things sort of ad hoc, because I think there are problems with cytopenias, and I think that needs to be figured out, what combinations are effective and how they should be given, what schedules they should be given in. So I think it will be very, very useful for patients with IDH2 mutations, and it's being tested now, as I mentioned, in the frontline, both in combination for patients with IDH2 mutation and as a single agent in frontline therapy for older adults with AML.
I'm going to get into this with FLT3, but as long as we're talking about IDH mutations, is that something that is there from the beginning and stays and doesn't evolve, or can you see changes either way?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions. I think many people believe that IDH mutations are an early mutation, sort of one of the quote-unquote founder mutations. So whether they stay present or not, I definitely think that they are often still present, even at the time of relapse and progression of disease. I've seen that. That was that one challenging case of AML that I mentioned to you, who had an initial response to an IDH2 inhibitor and then progressed and had a new mutation. So I think it's an early mutation, and perhaps targeting it early in the course of the disease will be very useful. I'm not so sure later when other clones emerge that have additional mutations.
Anything that's known in terms of mechanisms of resistance to these agents?
Yeah, well, I think that not that much is known yet, but it definitely happens. And I suspect it's because there are other subclones present that evolve with additional mutations that then drive the leukemia. And that's what I've seen in this one patient of mine who now has a clone that has a FLT3 ITD mutation.
Wow. Yeah, I want to ask you about that. So you've got a couple cases here of FLT3 mutant AML, and there's certainly a lot going on there. Maybe we can just briefly go through them, beginning with your 26-year-old lady.
So the 26-year-old, and this has just gotten approval, this combination for frontline therapy. This was a patient who was entered a number of years ago on our international trial led by the Alliance, the group in which we participate, led by my colleague, Rich Stone. And this trial was an international trial testing in a double-blind, placebo-controlled fashion the addition of an early FLT3 inhibitor, mitostorin, to frontline treatment and consolidation therapy for patients with FLT3 mutant AML, both internal tandem duplication and kinase domain mutation AML. And it was a very, very huge effort to do this trial. I commend Rich and my colleague Dick Larson for sort of spearheading the efforts internationally for this trial.
And I got to say, too, because, you know, there was that trial, there was the plenary presentation at ASH, and then the year before that was Serafinib. But, you know, just before you get into it, that was the time that for me, all of a sudden, I was thinking, wow, I think things are about to change.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, really, it is quite exciting. And even though the data suggests that the survival advantage is small, I think it's a very important advantage.
Yeah, but I mean, it's been so long since anything happened.
Exactly.
To me, just seeing that something was happening and that they pulled this trial off.
Yes, that was a huge success. It was really the first such trial to use huge screening process to enroll patients internationally. And because these diseases are rare and because the subset, this is a common subset in AML, up to 25% of adults with AML will have a FLT3 mutation. But even so, thousands of patients got screened for this trial before the numbers were finally accrued. And it showed a significant benefit to the addition of mitostorin. And that benefit, interestingly, persisted even in the patients who got transplanted, which is the current recommendation to still move forward with an allogeneic transplant in first remission for FLT3 mutant AML. And 40% of the patients on the big international trial did go forward with transplant in first remission.
I'm just kind of curious now that this is being used in clinical practice, and this lady, I guess we should say, did really well. She went into CR and then got transplanted. What's her current situation?
She's in remission, which is wonderful. There's a big controversy now, too, about whether or not these inhibitors should be added post-transplant,
right,
similar to the pH-positive patients. That wasn't one of the aims of this trial. And there are studies going on in the transplant communities looking at different FLT3 inhibitors frontline post-transplant to prevent relapse. And of course, as you probably know, there are many other very, very potent FLT3 inhibitors that are moving up forward in the relapse setting. And actually, that goes to that 76-year-old patient of mine.
I want to hear about that, but just to finish out in terms of this upfront story. So today, right now, if this 26-year-old woman presented to you, what kind of trial would you be thinking about? And what kind of non-trial therapy? And if you were going to use mitostorin, which I assume you would, how would you use it? And would you use it after transplant?
Well, I would use it exactly how it was published in the New England Journal, and I would use it frontline, and we are using it frontline. Right now, there is in the U.S. no frontline trial for FLT3 mutant AML in the U.S. intergroup. I'm sure there are centers that are doing other trials. So I would use it. I would still take this patient to transplant. Whether or not a FLT3 inhibitor should be used in the post-transplant setting, the data are not out yet. And I think it's reasonable if they're tolerating it, but there's really no data yet, I think, to support it.
What kind of tolerability issues do you see with just mitostorin alone?
I have never used the drug alone, but clearly we could almost tell the patients who are on the drug because there is GI toxicity. All of the FLT3 inhibitors that we've used have some GI toxicity, some more than others, but that's the main toxicity and some cytopenias.
When you look at a patient like this globally in your own mind, or even if the patient asks you starting out, what would you say the likelihood is of being cured in this situation through transplant? And how is that likelihood affected by using mitostorin in your own mind?
Well, what the trial showed was that there was an 8% improvement in survival with the addition of mitostorin. And the overall survival on that trial, actually, I'm embarrassed, I don't remember, but it's around, for the patients who prolonged survival, who got mitostorin, I believe that survival was close to 60% overall survival on that trial.
And when you say survival, are you talking about cure?
Potentially cure. Yeah, this is long-term follow-up now on this trial. And the Kaplan-Meier curve is very flat after about 4 or 5 years. Very flat.
So to get into the issue of the other FLT3 inhibitors, because I kind of wonder, for example, how a patient like that's going to be treated 3 years from now. Maybe you can speculate on that.
I think that there are better FLT3 inhibitors, more potent ones. And one of the problems with all of the FLT3 inhibitors, including the more potent ones, is the emergence of resistance with kinase domain mutations, and similar to what we've seen with imatinib, but I think more common even, way more common potentially. But there are some much newer ones that have a lot of activity and may quickly work in combination to eradicate the malignant clone, and then you wouldn't have the emergence of a resistant clone.
So I'm curious, because the one certainly we've heard a lot about is gilteritinib. We saw some data at ASCO on that, and that's what this 76-year-old lady got. What was her situation when she went into that trial, and what happened?
So that trial is a randomized trial for relapse patients, and it's randomized to sort of investigator's choice, a couple options. So we were hoping and praying that she would get randomized to the gilteritinib, since she'd already received pretty intense treatment, and she had been a patient who was right on the borderline in terms of transplant ability, but she adamantly declined transplant and had relapsed relatively quickly. So she was fortunately, in my opinion, randomized to the gilteritinib arm of the trial, and she's been taking it now for about 5 months. She is not in a complete remission, but her counts are pretty stable. She doesn't have any circulating blasts. She's not neutropenic. She is somewhat transfusion dependent, and she still has disease in her bone marrow. So she is not in a complete remission, but she's very functional. She's living a good quality life at the moment. And I worry, because I don't think this is going to last forever, this response.
So any tolerability issues with the gilteritinib? You mentioned GI problems. Did she have any problems?
Yeah, she has some GI toxicity. And then, of course, there's some fatigue. But is that the drug? Is that the disease? It's really hard to know. I think it's, in general, pretty well tolerated by the patients that I've given it to, potentially better than some of the other FLT3 inhibitors like sorafenib, which is a tough drug to take at the doses that are recommended in AML.
Maybe you could just briefly review what we know about, you know, we have midostaurin and particularly gilteritinib that kind of looks like it's kind of a little bit different than midostaurin.
Right. There's a couple out there that are being tested. There's a drug called quizartinib, gilteritinib, and crenolinib. And they're all quite potent FLT3 inhibitors. Some of them, interestingly, and this is one of the nuances, is that gilteritinib and midostaurin, for example, and crenolinib, all inhibit both the ITD mutation, which is the more common, and the kinase domain mutation. And why is that might be important? The kinase domain mutation may not be particularly important in terms of prognostically, although I'm not sure about that at all. But one of the things is, when you use a drug, for example, like sorafenib, what often happens is an emergent clone with the kinase domain mutation comes to the forefront. And so it's potentially better to block both potential FLT3 mutational types. And those three drugs all do that. The new generation, the three, crenolinib, gilteritinib, and quizartinib, are all more potent and have, as single agents, induced complete remissions, which we haven't seen with the earlier generation. Midostaurin, as a single agent, will not induce a complete remission. I would never advise using it as a single agent to treat a relapsed patient.
So how do you think this is going to play out over the next couple of years? Which of these agents do you think are going to get approved, and how are we going to use them?
Yeah, well, I think they need to move forward. Some testing needs to be done in the frontline setting, but I think any of them might get approved. I think probably closest are quizartinib and gilteritinib to approval. And how will they be added? I think we need to learn that. And we need to learn whether we can use them in combination safely with both the hypomethylating agents and with standard chemotherapy for AML. So I think that they will be approved. And I think that we need to move them to the front line so that we can avoid emergence of resistance or clonal evolution of disease.
So you kind of touched a little bit on gemtuzumab, but do you want to kind of bring that in a little bit and kind of what you think might be happening and what you think is going to be done if it does get approved?
I think a lot of community oncologists will use it in the relapse setting, which is going to be its indication. It's not a great drug in terms of its single-agent response rate. It can be quite toxic. It can prolong cytopenias. And interestingly, the subset of patients who have done the best and have actually been shown to have an improvement in outcome are the patients where it was used in the front line in the favorable cytogenetic risk groups, the core binding factor leukemia. So it's interesting to think about in that setting.
in terms of new agents with AML, which is a bigger and bigger topic, there were a couple of things I wanted to sort of pick your brain a little bit about. And one of them is venetoclax. And of course, we've been talking a lot about that with CLL. Now we're talking about with mantle cell. We're talking about with myeloma. You know, it's popping up everywhere. But what about in AML?
Well, I think that's another drug that may get approval soon in AML. And the data still are not hugely robust, actually, but definitely combination therapy has been tested with hypomethylating agents with venetoclax, and it is an active combination. The durability of the responses, the duration, and the overall response rate, I don't think it's been very well defined yet. There aren't a lot of publications out there yet. A lot of people are using this drug, including us, occasionally when we've got very few options left, and maybe that's not the right time to be using it in combination with hypomethylating agents.
How's it tolerated, incidentally? And particularly, obviously, with CLL, everybody's pretty psyched up about looking for TLS,
tumor
lysis syndrome.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing that we have. You know, the current indication, of course, is to admit patients to initiate treatment. And while we still do that, we have not yet, at least in our hands, at our institution, seen any evidence of tumor lysis with venetoclax in AML.
Yeah, and actually, you don't hear about it in mantle cell or myeloma.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it's just so exquisitely sensitive in CLL.
Well, also the issue of actual BCL2 activity in these diseases. And it's said that CLL is more. I mean, I don't know how much it is in AML.
Right, how dependent the cells are on it.
Right.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it also may have to do with the fact that in CLL, you've got such a huge circulating disease burden, and the lymph node burden is quite high. And this effect seems to be so profound, so quickly in terms of lymphadenopathy, you know, attacking the lymph nodes. But interestingly, what you're saying is in mantle cell, you don't see that. So I didn't actually know that. But I haven't seen it at all in AML. And I don't know if it's just because of the bulk peripheral disease that's present in CLL, and that's what makes it so potent, or because what you said, that these cells are so dependent on BCL2. For survival.
Dr. Sashi Kumar told me of myeloma fame from Mayo Clinic that there's some kind of BCL2 assay out there and that it's higher in CLL, but I guess that's pretty early.
You mean in terms of its expression?
Yeah.
You know, it's clearly aberrantly expressed in both myeloid and lymphoid, acute lymphoid leukemia as well, and in myeloid leukemia. And many years ago, another failed study that we did was with an antisense to BCL2 in AML.
Wow.
And so we had the idea like around 2000, 2001, we knew it was aberrantly expressed in AML, and it was this oligonucleotide antisense BCL2 inhibitor, which we did as a big national study in the CALGB, and it was sadly a completely negative study. I think it was just the fact that potentially the antisense was just not very effective.
So speaking of unusual pathways, we don't get too much of a chance to talk about hedgehog inhibitors nowadays, maybe basal cell with vismodegib, which I always love hearing about because it's such a strange drug. But anyhow, I see you guys are kind of getting into this with glasdegib. What's that and what do we know about it in AML?
We've tested it in AML frontline, and actually there's a manuscript that's being submitted right now to publication. It was a large study adding it, not in a randomized fashion, to frontline therapy for patients with AML. And is it a home run? No. Is it potentially interesting? Yes. But how it will play with all of the other drugs that are coming forward, I don't know. The drug is actually not an easy drug to tolerate. It causes horrible taste changes.
That's what we heard about with vismodegib.
Yes.
Same thing.
Same
dysgeusia,
thing.
Right?
It is true. The other really weird thing or unusual toxicity is that there is very bad muscle cramping with this
right.
drug.
Right, same thing with vismodegib.
So it's not a particularly easy drug to take. It is oral, which is nice. And
how effective is it?
Well, again, it was a phase 2 trial, so no comparison, but the response rates were pretty high. This was previously untreated AML, as good as any other cytarabine-daunorubicin combination. And the disease-free survival, it's really hard. You cannot really compare with other trials because not randomized. But it certainly is tolerable, but not really perfectly well-tolerated. And it may improve response rates and durability, but I really can't say that because it's not been compared in a randomized fashion.
Any predictors of response or markers?
Yeah, that's another good question. Not to my knowledge. I don't know which subsets might be uniquely susceptible. I think they're looking for that now.
Yeah, the basal cell people will tell me stories about how they would stop the drug for Thanksgiving so people
they could eat the turkey. It's terrible. The taste changes don't go away that fast. The other thing that I've noticed, which I've actually asked the developers of the drug, is that a lot of my patients have had trouble regrowing their hair.
Oh.
So I don't know. They said no, they haven't seen that. But in the limited number of patients that I've had, it's been a problem.
All right. Well, let's just finish out. We'll take 3 minutes and talk a little bit about APL just because I like talking about it. And I think your case, I wanted to ask you about your case. There's a couple of things about it that look interesting. Your 24-year-old Costa Rican immigrant lady.
The reason I mention that is because there's a higher incidence of APL in Hispanic patients. And interestingly, there's a tremendously high incidence in Costa Rica.
Costa Rica, wow.
Yeah, well, the reason I know that is that I have a friend who's a hematologist in Costa Rica, and they see large number of cases. And this patient is actually a Costa Rican woman who immigrated to the United States as a teenager.
Wow.
And so it's kind of interesting.
I've heard people say that these Hispanic women who get APL tend to be obese.
Well, overall, it's not just the women. There is a correlation in APL with obesity.
So in general, APL is correlated with obesity?
It's interesting. There seems to be a higher incidence. Now, this particular patient is not the least bit obese. But there are data published, and I think others have observed it, that obesity and APL are somehow correlated.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm always interested about how the stories start and how the people get diagnosed. What happened with her?
She actually is a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and she was noticing, she was feeling more fatigued, and interestingly did start noticing bruising, very high frequency of bad bruises, and she showed up in the student care, and they looked at her. I think the first time she came, I'm not even sure they drew her blood, but the second time she came back, like a day later, they drew her blood and they noticed the abnormal counts and quickly called us about her. So fortunately, she was diagnosed without too much delay, because I think that's probably the biggest issue to discuss in APL.
Right. That always is interesting. So usually I hear that you were called on a Friday night.
This was probably not on a Friday night, but yes, that's the leukemia doctor's story. But it does seem to be, of course, there are medical emergencies because people can die very quickly with this disease. And that's really the biggest challenge right now, is sort of educating the emergency room doctors about the possibility of this disease, because when a patient presents with cytopenias and potential DIC, you have to think about acute promyelocytic leukemia.
Do we have any numbers, at least in the United States, in terms of, let's say, total number of patients diagnosed per year, but total number of early, maybe preventable deaths? Any guess what that is?
No, I don't know the number. You know, it's such a rare disease, but I suspect that that's the big problem with this disease now, that people are waiting. It's often a disease seen if you're a younger person, you're not particularly attuned to the fact that anybody who would think that you have an acute leukemia if you're not feeling great. And so I'm afraid that a lot of these people come and they're right at the cusp of having a major catastrophic bleed or thrombotic event.
And this lady, you say, was in mild DIC at diagnosis.
She was, and she actually had a little bit in the way of a retinal hemorrhage going on. She had some vision changes, and so the key there is, once the diagnosis is made, or even if you suspect the diagnosis, which actually with a circulating blast, you can see the classic hour rods, but also the immunophenotype of APL is kind of unique, not totally unique, but it can help you along the road to diagnosis, and also the quick turnaround of FISH or PCR testing to make that diagnosis. But if you suspect it, there's really no harm in getting a retinoid started immediately, and that's what we always advise.
So what happened? You gave her Atra?
Yes, we gave her Atra immediately.
And what happened to her DIC?
It starts to resolve almost immediately. Literally within days, even within 24 hours, it starts to improve. And within days, it's usually gone.
What was her white count?
Her white count was not high. She was not a high-risk patient. It was about 8,000, if I recall. We have seen a number of patients with high white count, APL, and the approach to those patients is still not quite clear whether they should be treated the same as a low-risk patient or whether they need additional chemotherapy.
Are you generally giving them chemo?
We are generally giving them maybe a little chemo during induction to control the proliferative nature of the disease, a couple days of an anthracycline, idarubicin or daunorubicin, but otherwise we treat them the same.
Getting back to the issue of upfront diagnosis, to what extent is the lack of availability of ATRA to emergency rooms an issue?
Yeah, it's a problem. In fact, we sometimes get patients who are sent to us, and then again, there's that big delay, hours delay or half a day delay, because their hospital or their emergency room does not have ATRA. And it's certainly a very expensive drug for a very rare disease. So you can sort of understand why places don't have it in their formulary.
Although I've heard that I think there's some southern network of hospitals or something that they somehow have kind of an emergency system to get people ATRA.
Yeah, anything? I think there are such systems and it makes some sense. I mean, it's so appropriate. And I'm sure that there are those mechanisms in place where you can get an emergency supply sent quickly, but you have to have the idea that this might be the problem, because another 12 hours can make a life or death difference.
So this lady ended up on the Lococo regimen?
She did. That's been our sort of standard over the last number of years now, and she's gotten absolutely no chemotherapy in the standard sense, only ATRA and arsenic. And she's done extraordinarily well. It's a little bit of a pain in the neck to treat for these patients because they have to come daily for the arsenic during their pulses of arsenic. And the interesting thing is that other countries, including this friend of mine in Costa Rica, are exploring the use of oral arsenic, which has not been very well developed here. And that would make a big difference in terms of ease of administration and probably cost.
That's interesting. I never heard that.
Yeah. You can actually take the IV arsenic and turn it into an oral preparation and flavor it. That's what this friend of mine in Costa Rica, it's very innovative.
You take the IV stuff and drink it?
Essentially, yes.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's cool.
They reformulate it.
Maybe make a smoothie or something.
Yeah, well, he has a number. He has like coconut. He has lemon. He has all these different flavors. He's actually presenting the data at a meeting next month in Houston.
Wow.
Yeah, and the Chinese have done it for a long time. So,
huh.
Yeah.